This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. There's been a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court since February after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. It's been 251 days since President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, a federal appeals court judge, to fill that vacancy. Today, Where We Live, we look at the process to select the next justice after Republican Senate leadership refused to vote on Obama's nominee. Coming up, we'll check in with Connecticut Congressman Jim Himes. He'll tell us how Donald Trump's fast-approaching presidency is affecting the climate in Washington. But first, is there any chance Merrick Garland could be appointed to the nation's highest court? Or is that choice squarely in the hands of President-elect Donald Trump when he takes office? We'll hear from a reporter from Politico who will help us answer those questions and more. Also, we will consider some of the biggest issues that could come before the U.S. Supreme Court. What will happen to the right to an abortion? Will the new administration respect the Bill of Rights? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email Where We Live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome Akhil Reed Amar. He's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He teaches constitutional law in both Yale College and Yale Law School. And he's also the author of several books, including The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. He joins us from the studios of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Akhil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us on the phone, Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico. He specializes in legal and national security issues. Josh, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you.
So I'll start with you, Josh. At this point, does Merrick Garland have any chance of becoming a U.S. Supreme Court justice?
No. I would say it's basically zero chance at this point. The Republicans signaled that they were not going to take up that nomination even before the election. And now there's especially little reason for them to do so. And so it's all basically on hold, waiting to see what Donald Trump might do next year after he takes office.
We hear there's a list with 21 names on it. Any idea of who Trump will appoint as a justice?
It's hard to know. You know, he crafted that list with assistance from some conservative organizations like the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. There have been a couple iterations of it. The first one that came out had mostly state court judges, state Supreme Court judges, and other people that I think were not terribly well known. The more recent version added in a few people who were on the federal bench. It's hard to say who the real front runner there is, and I don't think it's a top priority for Trump right at the moment. He certainly seems to have his hands full resolving his cabinet appointments and some of the conflict of interest issues that are swirling at the moment. So I think we're all going to be in suspense at least for a couple months here.
Akhil, I'm sure you've seen those names on the list. Any reacts to some of those possible choices?
It's a very sober list. It's the sort of list that one might expect any Republican president to have embraced, to the extent there's maybe any difference between this list and another that might have been generated by a President Mike Pence or a President Mitt Romney or President John McCain or Scott Walker or Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. It might be that this list was a little bit more focused on folks from the heartland, not as many New York, D.C., San Francisco, L.A. types. So there were a couple of notable omissions, Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit, Paul Clement, a prominent lawyer, former Solicitor General, also in D.C., But I was with Hillary, and I'm critical of other aspects of the Trump platform. And but his list of judges actually does not unduly concern me. I don't think your audience should think that these are hacks or loyalists to Trump or partisans in any way. They're as a group well respected jurists.
Tell us more about the influence of Antonin Scalia in the court, and in terms of that, the characteristics that Trump is looking for in the next justice.
Well, truthfully, I don't know that Trump has really thought through a lot about what he really is looking for. I think he's not has never really been focused on the Constitution or jurisprudence. So he's getting talking points from other folks. You mentioned the Federalist Society. I was actually just down at the Federalist Society National Lawyers Convention last week in Washington, D.C. It was an event whose opening day was dedicated to Antonin Scalia and his legacy. Justice Scalia's son, Eugene Scalia, was in attendance. And Justice Scalia is in some ways a patron saint of modern judicial conservatism. He championed ideas like textualism, originalism, paying attention to the original intent of the Constitution. He perhaps wasn't always perfectly faithful to his principles, but he did have principles and advocated them, and that made him distinctive because lots of judges kind of muddle through and never even try to have a coherent philosophy or jurisprudence. Justice Scalia did. As I said, critics might say he didn't always live up to his own high standards, but he did have them, and they included commitments to text and to the history behind the Constitution, the original meaning and spirit of the Constitution.
I want to turn back to Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico. Tell us about the process. So you said that the Trump administration right now is just trying to figure out, you know, who's filling what cabinet positions. But with the Republican majority in Congress, any idea what the Democrats are thinking? Will they try to obstruct this process?
Well, the Democrats are in a little bit of a tough spot. In theory, they have the ability to obstruct a nominee through the filibuster process, where you need 60 votes in order to clear a nomination, a Supreme Court nomination, out of the Senate. The problem for them is that several years ago they rolled back aspects of the filibuster covering judges to the appeals courts and the lower level courts, and covering executive branch nominations. So it would not be that radical a move for the Senate Republican majority to cancel the filibuster altogether. So right now there's sort of a delicate standoff where Democrats are promising to be somewhat restrained in their use of the filibuster, which, remember, they may want to use not just for a Supreme Court nomination, but for legislation as well. And so there's sort of a standoff with Democrats saying they're going to keep their powder dry on the filibuster, while Republicans say, most of them anyway, that they're not going to mess with it at the moment. I think that kind of a situation, detente, if you will stay in place probably even for the next Supreme Court nominee that Trump makes, with the real test of that system perhaps coming for, say, a second Supreme Court nominee, where you'd really be looking at somebody who does have the potential to change the outlook and the makeup of the court, as opposed to swapping a conservative for a conservative in crude terms for Scalia's seat for whoever Trump may pick as his first Supreme Court nominee.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about the future of the U.S. Supreme Court with Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico, and Akhil Reed Amar, a professor of law and political science at Yale University. If you have a question for our guest, 860-275-7266. You know, I wanted to pick up on that thought, Josh, about, you know, swapping a conservative with a conservative. So much attention on who will fill this vacancy because it's been such a long time since Justice Scalia passed. But I wanted to turn back to Akhil now. So the real concern is with the three other justices who are all, reaching a considerable age, and what will happen when that next appointment comes down the line.
By three, I assume you mean Justice Stephen Breyer, a Democratic appointee, mm-hmm. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, another Democratic appointee, and Justice Anthony Kennedy, who, while picked by President Reagan, actually had to be confirmed by a Democrat-controlled Senate. Joe Biden was the head of the Judiciary Committee, and someone who is proverbially seen as a swing justice, who sometimes sides with liberals and Democratic appointees and sometimes with conservative appointees. And they are indeed the three eldest members of the court. I think we might be getting a little bit ahead of ourselves if we start thinking about those possible vacancies or others. Since Josh mentioned the filibuster reform, and I think he was absolutely right to do so, what he was invoking was the so-called – or referring to as the so-called nuclear option, by which a simple majority of the Senate on any day can determine that they're going to, in effect, do away with the filibuster and restore majority rule to the Senate, either for certain kinds of actions or across the board. I was actually one of the architects of filibuster reform, of the nuclear option, and I believed it when the Democrats controlled the Senate. I still believe in it when the Republicans control the Senate, because for most of American history, we really have not operated under a rule that in order to get anything important done, you needed 60 votes or 67. For most of American history, almost everything happened with the Senate acting by simple majority rule. And I think in the long run, we're going to have to go back to that, because otherwise we're going to just face continued gridlock and dysfunction.
We're getting a tweet from a listener. The question is, how does President-elect Trump find someone who is pro-gay marriage and anti-abortion and Second Amendment?
Pro-gay marriage and
anti-abortion and I press pro-Second Amendment.
Well, gay marriage is here to stay whatever the Supreme Court does. It's basically a fait accompli. The society has embraced it. It'd be hard to move back from that. I do agree with the tweet that President Trump will nominate someone whom he believes will carry on the legacy of two important Supreme Court cases. One is called Heller. One is called City of Chicago versus McDonald, both of which affirmed a right of an ordinary law-abiding citizen to have an ordinary handgun basically in the home for self-protection. And anyone that President Trump nominates is probably going to be someone whom he would predict is going to be in favor of that, and that will come up in the confirmation hearings probably. And then President Trump has said that he's opposed to Roe versus Wade, and you can expect that the nominees that he would put forth would probably likely share that view. But remember, it's improper for any judicial nominee to make a promise of any sort that once confirmed, I will vote this way or that way. You might actually be able to make predictions about what a person is likely to do. You might even ask them how they think about an issue today, and they'll duck the question often. But promises are improper. They're unethical for a judicial nominee to make.
Can we talk about some of the cases that are before the Supreme Court now? Josh Gerstein, again, White House reporter for Politico. There is the trans rights case, for instance.
Yeah, there is this transgender rights case out of North Carolina that was going to address the issue of what the federal government's role is in enforcing transgender rights in this instance in a school, but it has come up in similar situations in the workplace as well. And the Supreme Court agreed to hear that case actually a few months ago, put on hold a lower court ruling that ruled in favor of the Obama administration's efforts to accommodate transgender students according to their gender identity. It was a controversial ruling, and in a kind of interesting move, Stephen Breyer, who's on the liberal side of the court, joined with the conservatives in putting that decision on hold. He said, as a courtesy, so that it could be reviewed and the status quo would stay in place in the meantime. What we don't know with that case, as well as some others, is whether the Trump administration is going to essentially come in and change course and say, we don't believe in the underlying policy anymore, and we'd like to see the Supreme Court punt this back down to the lower courts. It's all part of the effort we're expecting from a Trump administration to unwind a lot of the executive actions and executive decrees and even regulations that the Obama administration issued on that issue, on the environment, on labor rights and others over the past 8 years, but fairly intensively in the last year or so.
Also, with the, you know, we're hearing about repeal and replace parts of the Affordable Care Act, you know, the question about contraceptive coverage, depending on if people work for a religious organization, what would happen with that?
Well, the Supreme Court has already kind of punted that issue back to the Obama administration, saying that it looked like the two sides essentially had a compromise there. The two sides I referred to were the administration and a bunch of mainly Catholic organizations, nonprofit groups, and so forth that didn't want to provide certain kinds of contraception to their employees and felt the administration had not done enough to accommodate that religious point of view. The Supreme Court essentially forced them into mediation, which is a little bit of an odd situation, but they did that. But now the thinking is that, assuming that won't be fully resolved under the Obama administration, the Trump administration may come in and offer something much more broad to, in terms of an accommodation to the religious groups, some sort of a wholesale exemption, which might not really be that significant, depending on how the dismantling of Obamacare is carried out, how fast it's carried out and how complete it is, and what some of these provisions for so-called preventive services and day-to-day medical treatment, if any of them survive through the Obamacare repeal and replace process that the Republicans are promising.
And Akhil Reed Amar, again, a Yale law professor, I'm curious what you'll be watching in the next weeks and months in terms of these cases.
Thanks. I agree with Josh that several of the most important issues do involve questions about the legal position that the Trump administration will take. And the court will be very interested in what the executive's position is. And the executive's position is going to be framed not just by the president of the United States, but by his attorney general. He said it's going to be Jeff Sessions, but Jeff Sessions hasn't been confirmed. And Jeff Sessions, if confirmed, would be the head of the Justice Department. A very important person in that Justice Department would be the Solicitor General of the United States, the person tasked with arguing the administration's position before the Supreme Court. We don't have that person yet. And again, there would be a Senate confirmation process. So until actually Trump has his full legal team in place, it is a little bit premature to start thinking about what a court would do, because one thing that a court wants to do is hear from the administration, and the new administration may have different views than the outgoing Obama administration.
I want to thank Josh Gerstein, White House reporter for Politico. He specializes in legal and national security issues. Thanks for the update, Josh.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Akhil Reed Amar, he's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He's going to stick around because we want to answer your questions. Again, he joins us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut. Now, do you have questions about who could fill current and future vacancies on the U.S. Supreme Court? And what could that mean for laws like Roe v. Wade? We're going to wade into that coming up. Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and what impact it could have under a new administration. Akhil Reed Amar is with us from the studios of Yale University. He's Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, where he teaches constitutional law in both Yale College and Yale Law School. He's also an author of several books, including The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. Now, he's on the line, so do you have a question or comment about the future of the U.S. Supreme Court? You can join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Email Where We Live at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, Akhil, I wanted to go back. You mentioned briefly Roe v. Wade in the last segment, and a lot of people are wondering, based on what President-elect Donald Trump said to 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago about how he wants to send it back to, it'll be overturned and sent back to the states. What's your opinion on that?
Well, he won't be able to do that unilaterally. That will ultimately depend on the United States Supreme Court. Roe is a controversial case. It's as controversial today as the day it was decided. That's not true of every important case. Brown versus the Board of Education had a lot of critics in 1954. Every Southern senator, that is, senator from the former Confederacy, signed a manifesto, a Southern manifesto against Brown v. Board, except Al Gore Sr., the father of the later vice president, Estes Kefauver, both from Tennessee. D.C., and Lyndon Johnson from Texas. So Brown was controversial then, and now everyone says, oh, Brown, of course, is right. Separate is unequal, and we shouldn't have segregation. Roe, by contrast, remains controversial today. There are justices on the Supreme Court who have called it into question. On the other hand, it has been repeatedly reaffirmed in one very prominent case in 1992, a case called Casey out of Pennsylvania. And more recently, last term, there was another case that basically reaffirmed the core of Brown when Texas tried to shut down a whole bunch of abortion clinics with medical reasoning that really wasn't very sound and that was really pretextual, and they got called out by the Supreme Court. So Roe has been repeatedly affirmed by the court. It's been softened, and the court has backed away from some of the most extreme statements in Roe. On the other hand, there are justices on the Supreme Court today who think that Roe was basically wrong. Justice Thomas has said that repeatedly. Justice Alito has said that repeatedly. Chief Justice Roberts has intimated that. So those are three votes right there. Presumably, President Trump's nominee to the court might share that view, although, again, no one should ever make a promise in the confirmation process one way or another. But that might be four votes to at least not expand Roe and maybe start to trim it back further. Whether it would be formally – and that's only four votes and you need five – but whether it would ever be formally overruled – maybe it wouldn't have to be. John Roberts might be able to lead a conservative court were he to get yet another vote to basically hollow Roe out, to allow states much more flexibility while formally preserving some of the facade of a right to abortion, but giving legislatures much in various states much more flexibility to restrict abortions in various ways.
Now, didn't Texas have a law that went before the court, and they decided based on the state's restrictions cannot put an undue burden on a woman's right? And so, how would that come into play?
Exactly. So that was just last term, and the conservatives on the court really didn't challenge centrally the undue burden analysis of Justice Breyer. But there it stands. It's a recent opinion for a clear court majority. Most importantly, joined by Justice Kennedy, a Reagan appointee. So those are five votes. On the other hand, we have to remember that the Supreme Court has the right, indeed sometimes the duty, to overrule itself if it thinks that earlier cases were mistaken. Think of how Brown versus Board of Education itself basically repudiated the earlier landmark case of Plessy versus Ferguson. So the courts, even though Roe has been recently reaffirmed by this important Breyer opinion out of Texas last term, that's five votes, it wasn't six or seven or eight or nine. And were President Trump to get another nomination after the current filling the current vacancy, your audience should expect that Roe is on the table, up for grabs. That's the reality.
So what would it mean if it's overturned when we look at individual states? I mean, who would be the people affected by that?
Well, again, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves because we're projecting pretty far out in the future. For Connecticut, I'm not sure it would make a big difference because the Connecticut legislature will decline the invitation that a court might offer to turn back. Remember, none of the conservatives on the court are saying that you have to prohibit abortion, a state legislature. They believe only that a state legislature can choose to do so. Well, lots of state legislatures in blue America will choose not to do so. That will be likely true in New York and Rhode Island and Connecticut and Massachusetts, just to pick our neck of the woods. So the places where it would make a difference would be red America, where legislatures in places like Texas or like the Deep South or the Midwest, red state legislatures might be inclined to try to restrict abortions in various ways, late term abortions, or abortions that use certain kinds of controversial procedures, so-called partial birth abortions and the like.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with Akhil Reed Amar. He's a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University, a constitutional law scholar, and he's here to answer your questions, 860-275-7266. We're getting a tweet from a listener, Nancy from Bethlehem. She wants to know how the Senate can hold up the nomination of Merrick Garland and whether that is legal or constitutional.
It is legal. It is constitutional. I'm a big fan of Merrick Garland's. You were kind enough to mention a couple of times this new book of mine, The Constitution Today. I have a couple of essays in it on my very high regard for Merrick Garland. But the Constitution doesn't require that the Senate roll over and approve anyone that a president nominates. It doesn't even require that the Senate vote on a nominee. It doesn't even require that the Senate hold hearings on any given nominee. I'll give you an example of where the Constitution does set out clear rules. When the House and the Senate both agree to a law, they send it to a president, and here's what the Constitution says. The president has 10 days, Sundays excepted, to either sign the thing or send it back, to veto it in effect. And if he doesn't basically act within 10 days with very specific exceptions that are again spelled out, it becomes a law. So the Constitution says, listen, you have 10 days, and if you don't act, it becomes a law. The Constitution could have said, but did not, listen, when the president nominates someone to the Supreme Court, the Senate has 30 days or 90 days, and if it doesn't act, the person's on the Supreme Court. But the Constitution says nothing of the sort. It doesn't treat justices who are nominees to the Supreme Court any different than nominees for lower federal courts, any different from nominees for a cabinet position or a sub-cabinet position. In fact, I've actually been nominated by President Obama for a position that requires the Senate to confirm me. It's a very low-level position. It's not a big deal, but I'm not going to get a hearing. I'm not going to get a vote. And there are thousands of people like me in American history who have been nominated by presidents for various positions, and the Senate has just let the nominations wither on the vine.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the Constitution, but I want to take a call now. Art's been holding from Windsor. Art, you're on the show.
Hi, how you doing, Lucy?
I'm doing well.
Good. I think you got a cool last name, Nalpathanchil. It just rolls right off the tongue. My question is, I think the name of the case was Fredericks versus California, maybe. It was a case about right to work and unions, and it looked like it was going to go towards giving people a right to work, and it ended up being a 4-4 tie when Scalia passed away. And that's one of my questions. And the second question is, I had heard that Clarence Thomas was thinking of retiring. I guess he's a big RVer and was thinking about retiring. So he may be one of the people that Trump has to replace. I wonder if you'd heard anything on that subject.
All right, Art, thank you for your questions. Akhil, first off, let's talk about Frederick versus California.
So that's a case in which the issue is whether or not people who work for public unions, government unions, teachers' unions, transportation workers' unions, can be forced to pay dues to the union, and whether those dues in turn can be used by the union for certain political purposes or even for just general union purposes. And there are four justices on the Supreme Court that basically are hostile to the idea that individuals can be made to pay dues to basically a political organization, a union whose political purposes the individual worker might not agree with. Now, on the other side, the argument is, listen, unions bargain on behalf of all their workers, and if you don't have to pay dues, you're free riding, you're benefiting from the collective bargain, but you're not actually paying your fair share. And what unions do can't be neatly distinguished from when they're bargaining about wages and hours, because they're bargaining with the state government, from some other maybe more political things that the unions are up to. And so some folks say people have to pay their fair share of union dues. And as I said, there are four justices who think that might violate the First Amendment because you're compelling someone to contribute to a political organization that they don't agree with. When Justice Scalia was on the court, there were indications that there were five justices ready to basically – in effect, really weaken public interest unions by saying people didn't have to pay dues of a certain sort. Justice Scalia passed away, so there was no longer a five-justice majority for that position. But now with the vacancy, there might well be, again, a five-justice majority. And a cynic would say this is an attack on a constituency, public interest unions, that's a pretty reliable Democratic constituency. So this is a way of defunding the Democratic side of the political spectrum. So that's that issue.
Now, Art was also asking about speculation that Justice Thomas could be retiring. I haven't heard that.
I haven't heard. I have no inside information, but here's what can be said on Art's behalf, that justices do get to time their resignations. It's a life tenure. It's not a life sentence. You're not forced to sort of live out, you know, the rest of your natural days at hard labor on the Supreme Court if you want to have a life. Justices, this is not a secret, have political and ideological points of view, and they're more likely to step down when the president is shares their general philosophy and where a president is likely to appoint someone who would sort of carry on their point of view. Their first choice is to live forever. Since that's not given to them, their second choice is in effect to try to clone themselves, as it were, to try to be replaced by someone who's a mini and younger version of themselves. And so, yes, often Supreme Court vacancies are replacement rather than a balance shifting. They're conservatives stepping down on the watch of a conservative president who appoints a younger conservative, or liberal justices stepping down on the watch of a liberal president who appoints a younger liberal. Justice Scalia's passing created the possibility of a balance shifting amendment. Remember, he didn't resign; he passed away, and he didn't want to pass away on Obama's watch. That's just what happened. But that had the possibility of shifting the balance because it was a conservative leaving the court through death, creating a vacancy that might have been filled by a liberal president nominating a liberal replacement, and that didn't happen because President Obama lost the midterm election in 2014 in the Senate, and he lost control of the Senate, and the Senate was controlled by Republicans and said no. If the Senate had been controlled by Democrats, that would have been a big balance-shifting change on the Supreme Court, really the first time since 1970 that we would have had a majority of Democrat appointees on the Supreme Court, because since 1970, basically the Republicans have had a majority on the Supreme Court.
We're also getting a tweet from another listener who wants to hear more about what the Supreme Court could do if voting rights are further curtailed.
One of the things that five Republican appointees on the Supreme Court did do in a case called Shelby County is undercut, overturn a key portion of the iconic Voting Rights Act of 1965, an act that Republicans and Democrats had voted for in Congress, an historic act spearheaded by Lyndon Johnson, aided by Martin Luther King. There's a whole movie about that. Not entirely accurate, not quite fair to Lyndon Johnson, who really was a great crusader for Voting Rights Act. It was a statute that changed the face of America. African Americans before that statute in many places had been disfranchised. They weren't allowed to vote despite the promises that had been made in the Constitution after the Civil War. But those promises had been broken, and the Voting Rights Act came along and created a new world in which blacks actually, especially in the former Confederacy, got to vote. In the 2012 election, blacks actually voted a higher rate than whites, which would never have been possible before 1965. But key portion of that iconic statute, the Voting Rights Act of 65, was invalidated in Shelby County and a bunch of states, Republican-controlled states in places like Republican-controlled legislatures in places like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Texas. Immediately, within days of the Shelby County decision, started passing laws restricting voting rights in various ways. Had the Voting Rights Act been in effect, the Justice Department would have had to take a look at those laws and had to pre-approve them before they went into effect. But the Supreme Court gutted a certain portion of that law, and made it easier for states to pass all sorts of laws restricting the right to vote in various ways. Those laws can be challenged in court, but that's a very cumbersome, expensive, tedious process. And that may have made a difference in places like Wisconsin, maybe North Carolina, maybe not for the presidential race, but for the gubernatorial race, and in other states.
Now, before we head to break, I did want to ask you about, a lot of the rhetoric of President-elect Trump concern people. I would assume concern you as a constitutional law scholar, when there's mention of registering Muslims. I mean, what's your concern moving forward? I know you say you don't want to speculate.
Oh, well, I am concerned about many of the things. Well, I don't want to speculate about a second or third vacancy on the Supreme Court, because now we're also having to imagine people resigning or passing away, and that's always a little awkward.
Yes.
But if you're asking, though, what the Trump administration will do, we can look at what things that Trump has already said in the campaign, several of which made me very nervous, and happily he's walking some of that back. He said he would lock her up. Even though there isn't really evidence that she's committed a kind of crime that anyone else in America has ever been convicted of or even prosecuted for. And he kept saying that over and over again, lock her up, lock her up. And people were roaring that, just crowds. That makes me a little nervous, because you need to really show me two or three people who actually went, who were convicted by doing things similar to hers. And I actually have not seen anyone who actually did something similar to what she did, whoever was prosecuted. People were prosecuted who lied to the FBI, but the FBI director said she didn't lie to us in the investigation, or who intentionally leaked government secrets, and she didn't do that. And so that made me nervous. Happily, just today, I was the Trump administration is walking that back, saying, oh, she's not going to be prosecuted, don't worry. But that made me nervous. That's a violation of civil liberties to go around locking up your opponents. Yes, having a registry, especially if it were of Americans, but even of immigrants based on religion, that's troubling on civil libertarian grounds. Saying, as Trump did repeatedly during the campaign, that people born in America aren't automatically citizens if their parents are immigrants or illegal immigrants or something like that. Well, the Constitution is really clear that the first sentence of the 14th Amendment says about as clearly as it's possible to say, especially when you pay attention to the legislative history of that sentence, that everyone born in America is an American citizen, full stop. It's birthright citizenship. The Supreme Court repeatedly affirmed that. That's what the framers of the 14th Amendment clearly intended. But on the campaign trail, Donald Trump repeatedly said, oh, he's not sure about that, and he wants to reexamine that. So he did say things. He says he's not so sure about American libel laws and whether the press should have the same the kind of broad protections of the First Amendment that it now enjoys. So he did say a bunch of things on the campaign trail that should make us uneasy. Happily, he's walking some of those back as we speak.
Well, I want to thank Akhil Reed Amar. The time is short. There's a lot to talk about, but I think you helped us get a better understanding of the Supreme Court and what's at stake in the months and years ahead. Akhil is a Sterling Professor of Law and Political Science at Yale University. He teaches constitutional law, the author of several books, including The Constitution Today, Timeless Lessons for the Issues of Our Era. Thank you, Akhil, for joining us.
Thanks, Lucy.
We'll take more of your questions and comments after the break, because coming up, we're going to talk to a member of Connecticut's congressional delegation about what he hopes can be accomplished under a GOP-led Congress. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Thursday, while we're preparing our Thanksgiving feasts, Best of the Best will present the winners of the 16th annual Third Coast Richard H. Dry House Competition. Meticulously crafted and lovingly produced, these stories will intrigue, inform, and inspire. That's Thursday morning at 9. Now, speaking of listening, we know many of you tune in to Where We Live on your car radio or stream us live at WMPR.org. But if you can't listen live mornings at 9 or evenings at 7, you can always subscribe to Where We Live on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or any podcast app. Now, today we've been discussing the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court under President-elect Donald Trump, but now we're going to switch gears and talk to Congressman Jim Himes. He represents the state's 4th district in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Himes, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you just won re-election to your 5th term. How are you feeling about the work you're about to embark on in January?
You know, I guess schizophrenic is probably the best description of how I'm feeling. You know, we were all back in Washington last week, and you know, I would say that my Republican colleagues are as shocked by the outcome of the presidential as the Democrats are, and equally curious to see what this new guy who is at the forefront of their parade is going to do and say. You know, there's obviously there's more of a smile on their faces than there is on the Democrats' faces. But look, at the end of the day, there's a pretty robust debate happening in Democratic circles about whether Donald Trump is a guy with whom you can find common ground and work together on some things. For example, what he featured in his victory speech, the question of infrastructure, which is absolutely essential to my constituents up here in Connecticut. Or whether this guy is going to be just so outrageous that you're eventually going to find yourself in a posture of, you know, defending things like freedom of the press and independent judiciary, and therefore not being in a position to work on infrastructure. Very much an open question.
So we were talking about the vacancy on the Supreme Court. You know, a lot of Americans frustrated that, you know, the vacancy has been so longstanding. I mean, what do you think is going to happen after January, after President-elect Trump is sworn in and picks his cabinet? You know, who are you, you know, are you concerned about who's going to replace the late Justice Scalia?
Well, of course I am. And, you know, here you have an example of a severe wound that was committed against the American body politic, not by Donald Trump, but by congressional Republicans. And I mean, if you know me, I represent a purple district. I'm usually not in the finger-pointing business, but you know, to do something utterly unprecedented, to essentially steal a Supreme Court appointment from a sitting president by saying that we're not going to consider any of President Obama's nominations, you know, that I think steal is the right word. I mean, really utterly unprecedented on a political basis to just say, sorry, the Constitution notwithstanding, we don't believe the president in his final year has a right to offer someone for approval by the Supreme Court. That's a pretty serious wound. And the reason I don't mind highlighting it as such is that by doing something so nakedly political, so nakedly harmful to precedent and the political process, what the Republicans have done is they've opened themselves up to the same sorts of shenanigans by the Democrats. I mean, why could Chuck Schumer not say, oh, gosh, McConnell got it wrong. It's not 1 year. It's actually 3 years. We're not going to consider anybody who has been nominated in the final 3 years of a president's term. You know, when you start messing around with those long-held, you know, precedents and norms, you get into this thing that makes us less functional, not more functional. So yes, of course, I'm concerned about the fact that, you know, Donald Trump may have the opportunity over his first term to appoint not one, but perhaps multiple Supreme Court justices. That doesn't make me happy, but I'm just as concerned about the, you know, absolutely outrageous treatment of President Obama with respect to Merrick Garland.
Let's talk about leadership now in the Democratic minority. You know, we were hearing from that, you know, Tim Ryan wants to take over for Nancy Pelosi. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, there's no question that when you lose, and when you lose as unexpectedly as the Democrats lost, you know, obviously with the precedent on down to the House, where I think we, right up until Election Day, had the hope or the expectation we might win, you know, if not certainly not the House majority, but, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 seats, and of course we wound up significantly lower than that. I think there's at least two conversations that need to be had. Number one is, what did we get wrong? And I think, you know, that conversation is going on in a very robust way right now in the Democratic caucus in the House and elsewhere. But then there's also a larger conversation to be had. What does it mean for our country if the person who gets almost 2 million more votes, 2 million more Americans saying, "Hey, I want you to be president," doesn't get to be president? You saw the panel decision of a federal court yesterday pointing at Wisconsin and saying these seats were gerrymandered on a partisan basis, which is a new statement from the judiciary. You know, yes, there is some soul-searching that needs to be done in the Democratic Party, but there's also some structural reforms that need to be made to our overall system so that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, whether you're in Connecticut or California or Ohio or Michigan, you say to yourself, you know what, this is a system whose leadership is going to reflect the desires of the people rather than, you know, either antiquated ideas like the Electoral College or gerrymandered House seats.
You say it's a system that should represent the people, but isn't that why, a lot of Americans who said they're fed up with the status quo, and that's what you've got now in Congress. So what have you been hearing from your constituents on, you know, do they believe that, you know, you're able to do the work for them and not the establishment?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a complicated statement, right? And it depends. People mean different things when they say that. You know, the proverbial blue collar white working class, you know, looks at what has happened, the change that has occurred both socially in the area of, you know, LGBT rights, in the area of transgender, the whole discussion around transgender. Looks at the Affordable Care Act, may or may not fully understand the repercussions of a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and comes out with this idea that the system is not working for me, and that's not illegitimate. I mean, you know, if you just simply look at the economic outcomes of the last 20 years, there are groups that have been either left behind or really haven't seen forward motion. Now, they may be in for a shock. I am watching with great interest what, of all the many, many things that Donald Trump said, what actually becomes policy, because if the things that he seems to be sticking with, and of course he's run from a lot of his previous campaign statements, but if the things that he's sticking with, which appear to be very substantial tax cuts, probably concentrated for the wealthiest Americans, and a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which is now covering 20 million Americans who didn't have insurance before, if those are the things that get through, boy, are the you know, however you define them, the population of folks that have been left behind economically, are they ever in for a rude shock as to what their, you know, populist president has done for them?
We only have a couple of minutes, Congressman Himes. I'm curious, though. You know, you seem like there's a lot that still needs to be seen when the work begins. But, you know, just from someone that has, you know, been a congressman for some time, the future of the Democratic Party, where do you think it leads?
Well, this is a debate that we're having right now, and it has to lead in one direction, which is we need to be able to have a larger support base. We can't, as much as it might have been tempting 2 months ago to say, well, the Republicans have white male non-college voters, to use one of the demographics that the pollsters talk about, and as much as it might have been comforting to say, but that is a declining demographic, there's two problems with that. One, there are constituents and their people, and they need to be represented and spoken to and feel like the Democrats are standing up for them. And that's gonna force a difficult conversation. I guess, look, the Democrats are going to get the economic argument right. We are and always have been the party that wants to promote Pell Grants so lower-income people can get the necessary schooling, who want a more progressive tax code so that you don't have carried interest of capital gains that is delivering huge tax benefits to very, very wealthy people. That part I have no worry we will get right. And, of course, there'll be little fights along the way. I mean, trade and TPP split the party, no question about that. But we're going to get the economic argument right. What I worry more about is the question of identity politics. I can't help but think, listening to my constituents, that the Democratic message delivered into some economically troubled demographics, the proverbial kind of white, blue-collar, socially conservative voter, they heard us really making arguments that we're very proud to make.
Congressman Hymes, we're almost out of time.
Equality.
Congressman Hymes, I apologize. We're almost out of time. Yeah. We're going to be watching. We'll want to check in with you come next year. Thank you so much for your time
Sounds
today.
Good. Okay, thanks very much.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil, and we hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving for all of our listeners out there. This is Where We Live.